welcome to episode 98 of Speak Beastie for October 20th, 2019. I'm Ariel.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Helene.
Yay, we're here. It's spooky.
I was like,
wait, you guys, is it more like spook beastie? Am I right?
Ooh, spook beastie.
That's right. It's more like spook beastie this month. Yeah, I just did.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Totally off the cuff. Love it. Love a good, I guess it's a pun. Yeah.
Wordplay. I guess. Wordplay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wordplay. Yeah. I'm sick, so I have an easy out for all of the things I'm going to mess up this episode. As for past episodes, I don't know what my excuse is.
Okay, I'm still playing my newbie card, so if I forget something, I'm just like, oh, I'm new.
Yeah,
what can
same.
I do about it?
Yeah. Play it as long as you can. So, a veteran and two newbies. It would have been two veterans and two newbies, but Shannon, unfortunately, is sicker than I am right now. Which, hope you feel better. Well, I mean, when the episode comes out, I really hope you feel better, because we're recording way ahead of time.
In all areas of space and time, we hope you feel better.
Yeah, Shannon.
Yes, yes. And anyone who has the post-con flu, hopefully that has also passed by this point. But I think that's a pretty good segue into the Phoenix Register, wouldn't you say, Helene?
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs knees and how.
I think that's the perfect segue, yes.
Yeah.
In the Phoenix Register this week, I'm going to talk a little bit about MuggleNet at New York Comic Con. We did our 20th anniversary celebrations over the weekend. At the time of recording, it was last weekend, so October 5th through 7th, I want to say. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a good time. We all, about 25 of us, all met up in New York for our 20th anniversary celebration. We did a panel that we called Into the Pensieve. Or pensive, I'm exactly not sure how to say it. I think we kind of debated about this at the event. I think it's pensive. So Into the Pensieve.
I think so, yeah.
Yes. So our panel was called Into the Pensieve, and we celebrated 20 years of MuggleNet with a variety show with lots of games and contests and all of that. One of them being the Arumpant Mating Dance Contest, where we had a few people from the audience come up on stage and show us their best Arumpant mating dance with the scene from the movie playing in the background. And we had a very special guest judge for this contest. And it was Dan Fogler himself. He showed up. He judged the contest. It was really fun. We kind of surprised everybody that was there. No one knew that he was going to be there. It was a nice surprise for everyone. And he told this really fun story before we started the contest about how Eddie pulled a muscle during the very first take of shooting that
gosh.
Scene.
So, I wouldn't say that's the most fun story, but, you know.
I mean, it was pretty funny. He told the story with a lot of physicality. And and it was just ironic how literally the very first take that they did of that scene, he ended up injuring himself. So, I mean,
poor Eddie. I relate to him so hard on that level. Like, that sounds like something I would do, just immediately injure myself. Bless his heart.
Yeah, so it was really fun getting to see Dan and have him kind of help us out with that celebration of the film during our 20th anniversary celebration. We also did a game of charades with Andy Miller from Puffs, if anybody has seen that. I think it's an off-Broadway play from mm-hmm. Matt Cox as a playwright. And so, yeah, Andy Miller is in that, and she helped us with some charades, which was really fun. And then on Saturday night, we had a progressive dance party at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square on Saturday night, which was basically we played music from 1999 all the way to 2019. So music from all of the years that Mogul Net has been around. And it was just a nice, fun dance party where we all got to hang out and blow off some steam and dance. So it was a good time.
Sounds like fun.
The FOMO is so real right now.
Yeah.
I think if you go on MuggleNet's Facebook, you can watch the panel. I think it's still there.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, it's a fun time.
Recording. Yeah, because I mean, I know y'all did a Facebook Live, and sometimes it's like, this has ended. So I don't know if, you know, someone kept it up. I would look right now, but my internet is pretty spotty. So if I open up another tab, who knows what kind of havoc would be wreaked.
If it's not there, I know that we did coverage of the panel on our MuggleNet Live Twitter account. So yes. You can go see all the fun there, see Dan and his fun surprise arrival. And I'm sure that they probably filmed some of the actual mating dance contest. So go relive that with us, because it was a really fun time.
Do you guys hear some rustling wings fluttering through the sky? Perhaps a mysterious hoot or two? I think we have some owls joining us during this week's edition of Owl Post. This is why people don't let me talk. So we have a couple of great pieces of Owl Post this week. The first is from, I apologize in advance, it's either Frogoat or Frogoat. Sorry.
I'm going to say frog.
Frogoat, you think?
Or frogoat.
Like a frog and a goat, right? Maybe.
Frogoat?
Yeah. Probably.
Frogoat. Yeah, I'm going with that.
Okay, well, Frogoat, please tweet or Facebook or Instagram, however you communicate with the show, and let us know if we got that right. And if not, how to pronounce it. Regardless, they said, I don't know if this has been talked about much, but did anyone else find it odd that Tina is never confirmed to be on official ministry business during Crimes of Grindelwald? Despite her own postcard to Queenie and her mention of reporting what she knows about Yusuf, the French ministry has no record of her presence in Paris, nor do any of the other ministry officials mention her throughout the film. Is Tina secretly following her own leads without approval, much as she did in the first film? Is this part of Grindelwald's plot to drive Queenie to his side by isolating her and making her doubt herself, or is something else going on?
I definitely always thought it was weird that when Queenie gets to the French ministry and they're like, oh, we don't have Tina on record. Like, I thought that was very strange.
Yeah. I recently watched it again, and That was another moment, like you just said, that stuck out. Because she sends a postcard to Queenie and says, you know, this is where I am, come visit me in Paris. And I know we don't really know much what had happened with Tina after, like, we don't know what her position was at MACUSA, really, after everything that happened. And as far as I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, which sometimes I am. But I very well think that she could be looking for credence on her own, because she kind of doesn't even trust her own government, like with how they handled things the mm-hmm. first go around. I could definitely see her kind of going rogue, but in a good way. And I think her postcard to Queenie was kind of just like, you know, this is where I'm going to be. And Queenie just kind of naturally assumed she was there on ministry business, so that's why she went there. But Tina seemed, even when she's like going into the wall to go to the circus and everything, she seems very like shifty and
Yeah. Like, she knows she's not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Do we, like, know for a fact that it is Tina who sent that postcard to Queenie? Do we think maybe it could have been Grindelwald to get her to France?
Huh. I actually have not thought... Well, I mean, it was in her handwriting, so unless Queenie just has no concept of what her sister's handwriting looks like and Grindelwald...
Magic.
Like, yeah, I guess.
I'm looking at the text of the postcard right now in the screenplay. My dear Queenie, what a beautiful city. I'm thinking of you, Tina, and then it's signed with an X, like for a kiss. And we don't... I know we don't really know enough about Tina outside of these movies, but that doesn't... Now that I'm thinking about it, that doesn't sound like her. Like, it's not very...
I don't know, I have a sister, and I don't think I'd ever call her my beautiful sister. You know, that seems kind of an odd thing to call your sister. But, I mean, maybe that's the relationship they have. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, like I said, we don't know enough about... I feel like we don't really know enough about their relationship when it's just the two of them to make that judgment.
Yeah.
It is possible that also maybe Tina was in France on official business, but it was kind of supposed to be low-key, and maybe having... the ministry in France know that she was going to be there would have like tipped off someone that they weren't supposed to know, and so maybe she was like undercover, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's true. Because, I mean, Vinda seemed pretty familiar with the French ministry, didn't she? So maybe she's involved or works there somehow. They didn't want her to know that Tina was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't want anyone to know that she was there for Credence, because maybe somebody else in the ministry was also after Credence or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe they kind of knew that the ministry had been kind of infiltrated, because that one scene where Vinda is there with Abernathy, and I know he's in disguise initially, but maybe, like, they kind of have a hunch that, you know, the French ministry can't exactly be trusted. So maybe that's why she's kind of being covert about things. Mm-hmm. And even in the postcard, maybe it was kind of, you know, if Tina had written it to Queenie, maybe it was kind of open-ended and vague for a reason, you know, not like, hey, you know, watching some crimes and catching some bad people.
Yeah.
Like, come visit whenever. Like, you know, like, maybe she was just trying to be, like, maybe she wasn't trying to sound exactly like herself, but, like, maybe that would tip Queenie off as to, oh, okay, so, you know, this doesn't necessarily sound like you, but this is you, because, I don't know. Like, me and my sister... we always joke with each other. We're always like, oh, you're so ugly, you're so stupid. But, like, we obviously don't think that about each other. Like, maybe I would write my sister a letter and be like, oh, beautiful Brittany, glorious day that I am having here. And that would tip her off like, oh, okay, so things are happening. Like, you're up to, like, serious business. Like, maybe that's the relationship they have. I don't know. But we don't know much about Tina and Queenie's relationship other than what we saw in the first movie, and then we know they've been separated in the second movie. Like, that's about the extent of it. So,
yeah.
No, it could have been written by Grindelwald. It could have been written by Tina. I don't know.
I don't think that Tina would kind of go against Makuza again like she did in the first film, because I feel like they probably trust her a lot more now that she helped catch Grindelwald at the end of the first film. So I feel like they would give her the resources that she needed and trust her enough so that she wouldn't feel like she has to hide from them in this film, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, we'd hope, because they really screwed it up the first time.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, Tina was trying so hard, and Serafina was just like, I don't want to hear it. And I was like, come on, Serafina, get it together. That was a whole frustrating situation all on its own, but this is a very good comment, very good questions being posed by, again, Frogoat is what we're going with. So thank you. Thank you for sending that in. We do appreciate it. Gives us something to think about, obviously.
And the other piece of owl post that we received is from Bridget Flamekeeper. This is in response to a comment from episode 97, which was the episode where Marjolaine interviewed William Nadalam. She says, or they say, sorry, "Oh wow, Eddie is a love magnet. I'm not arguing at all, but that phrasing really takes the cake." Which I agree, because I when I was listening to that on the train in the morning, I started laughing out loud too. Which, you know, luckily a crowded Chicago train at 7 a.m., nobody's caring and that I'm laughing hysterically to myself.
It's good that he's basically the cinnamon roll that we've all, like, made him up to be in our minds. And he's that way in real life.
Yes, like his cast it is. It's great.
Like, yes.
He's just as lovable as we expected.
Yeah. Which is good, because, I mean, I feel like you can't play a character like Newt and be, like, a total jerk in real life. Like, that would really suck. I mean, that'd be really good acting, but I feel like he brings an authenticity to the role and his own Eddie charm to it as well. Like, it is Newt, but also it's like, but like, it's Eddie, you know? Like, he's the one of, like, pinch his little cheeks. Like, give him a hug.
Agreed.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, that's it for this week's Owl Post. The owls are leaving their roosts and taking off to parts unknown. So we'll see you next time, owls.
Bye, owls.
Thank you, owls. So for main discussion, we're going to be talking about Leta Lestrange. I'm warning you ahead of time, it kind of goes all over the place with this discussion because we have a lot of questions about who is one of my favorite characters in the second film, at least. So for Leta, I actually looked up the etymology of her name because I was curious, and her name actually means glad or joyful, and I don't think that necessarily describes Leta as we know her in the movie, but
I would agree.
I mean, like, yeah, okay. But, like, when do our names ever, like, describe us? You know, like,
it's well, just kinda, I like, mean, if you're a character made up by J.K. Rowling, your name probably describes you pretty well.
Yeah, your name means something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But it's just, I just thought it was, like, maybe she was just like, I like the alliteration, so let's go with Leta.
It is a good alliteration, well, I would think that.
Yeah.
Real quick, I was actually looking on Behind the Name for Leta a little bit earlier this evening to see if I could find any other information. And apparently the word Leta in Swedish means look or search.
Oh.
So I wonder if that was what Rowling was pulling for.
The internet did me wrong on this one, so. No, really, I looked it up on like three or four different sites. It was what Google came up with. And they all said a variation of glad or joyful, or one said like joyfully. I was like, that's basically the same thing. And then another thing it said was the mythological queen of Sparta and mother of Helen of Troy. And I thought that was interesting because I know a long, long time ago we talked about Theseus and the etymology of his name. And that tied back into Greek mythology, so I thought it was interesting that Theseus and
I'm trying to see if I can find out if like Lestrange means anything.
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah, oh good idea.
I didn't think to look that up.
It says like from Old French estrange, Middle English strange or foreign, and with the French definite article le. Hence, a nickname for a newcomer to an area.
Oh.
So it really just means, like, strange, foreign newcomer.
Who is searching. Or glad. Glad to be searching.
I don't think she's glad to be searching.
That's Leta, in a nutshell.
I don't know. I mean, it's odd because most, usually characters' names, like, really do mean something or have, like, a very strong connection to their character, but A, we don't know a lot about Leta yet, and B, it just doesn't seem to have a huge connection this time, which is not always, like, That's pretty normal sometimes, I guess.
And it could be like Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling just liked the name Harry, and she liked the, you know, last name Potter. So maybe she just thought, like, oh, Lita sounds nice with Lestrange, or I just like the name Lita, or she knew someone in her life named Lita who she wanted to honor. Who knows? You know, like, it just...
This is true.
Like, when I write, and I'm not, like, J.K. Rowling or anything, but when I write, sometimes I'll be like, this name sounds pretty, or I'll look up and be like, what does this name mean? Oh, this is perfect for this character. Sometimes it's, like, a coin toss, you know, it could be the absolute, like, answer to what the character means and what motivates them, or I could just be like, well, I liked that name, so I went with it. So
fair enough.
Who knows in the case of Lita, and what, you know, J.K. Rowling was going for. But big question, other than Lita's name, is she dead or alive? And I'm on the fence, but a few big questions about the deadness or aliveness of Lita Lestrange. Did Grindelwald's blue flames actually kill those people, or did they just imprison them? What would be the reasoning behind this? After recently watching the movie again, I don't know if I'm too sure if it was an imprisonment. I don't know what the purpose would serve for Grindy, but it just, there is some sort of level with Lita's death specifically where it doesn't feel final, you know, where her death felt different to the others, because even when the flames were chasing the oars that were trying to get away, or, you know, the other people who walked into the fire and weren't, like, that one, I don't know if he had a name, but one of Grindelwald's followers who, I guess, didn't have his whole heart into it, he burned up in the flames.
Mm-hmm.
With Lita, it just felt different. And I couldn't place my finger on it. I don't necessarily think it could be an imprisonment, but maybe somehow she escaped in the middle of it? I'm not sure.
Who knows? I just have a hard time believing that that they would introduce this strong, likable, complex character at the beginning of this movie and then just kill her at the end. And it kind of seems like her entire purpose is, like, to move forward Newt and Theseus's story, which is, if that's true, it's a huge disservice to her character because I really loved her. And when she died, I was just, like, in shock that they would do that, because I was so sure she was going to have a bigger part to play in this story. And she might still, I guess, but I don't want to believe she's dead. I want her to be alive because she still has so much more to do, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like if Credence can survive kind of like blowing himself up, why can Lita not, you know? And I'm kind of on the fence about it because I'm right there with you. I loved Lita's character. I loved her complexity. I love Zoe Kravitz. I loved learning about her story. I loved seeing the flashbacks of her Newt at school. There was so much I loved about her character, and I think they should bring her back, but then it's also kind of like, does anyone ever really die in these films? You know? So it's kind of like,
yeah,
at a certain point, someone needs to stay dead, but I'm like, but not Lita, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like she was this really great balancing, this great balance between Newt's, like, logical, like, straightforwardness and Theseus's, like, leading with his heart and very emotional. I thought that she was, like, a good balance between that, and she kind of helped bring that balance to their lives and the story. And it just makes me upset that, like, if she doesn't come back, like, she's going, it's just the story is going to miss her. It's going to it's going to be weird without her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I am 100% team hashtag Lita lives.
Trending?
I submitted actually an owl post in the last episode about this very issue, about and Just for anyone who didn't necessarily listen to last week's episode, which you should go back and do because it's phenomenal. I'm quoting from Calling All Witches, which is it's a spinoff, it's a tie-in novel or book, like reference book that from Wizarding World Press. And in Lita's section, it specifically says that she was last seen consumed by the flames Grindelwald had cast.
Oh.
And
That's an interesting word.
Yeah, and
yeah.
The point I raised in my owl post was that for Lily and Tonks and Bellatrix, they use very final language. They say that she sacrificed mm-hmm. herself. They say that Molly took her out. They say that she gave her life. But Lita was last seen.
Interesting.
And
that's very open-ended.
Exactly. And they make some very good points in that episode as well, that you can't have the fake out with Credence if he isn't really a Dumbledore, and you can't have the fake out with Lita not really being dead, otherwise the second movie basically is pointless. Yeah. But I feel like I'm sticking with this theory so hard because I love Lita so much and I do not want her to be fridged for Newt's man pain. Like, I am not on that train.
Yeah, like, if she honestly, like, just had to die in order to bring Theseus and Newt closer together, then, like, her entire existence does not pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
And that is not acceptable to me.
I just, like, you were saying, like, then the second movie would be useless. I'm like, well, it kind of was anyway, if we're being totally honest. Like, even when I first saw it, it just felt like exposition, the movie. And it was just so... there was just so much. And, like, Lita was, in my opinion, one of the strongest points of the movie. Mm-hmm. And it would be such a shame if that was her death. Because it felt so... like, it... like, it just... come on. Don't take away... like, there's no reason. I was going to say I shouldn't get into this, but, like, we're talking about her character.
Yeah, we're talking about
why
it.
Why not? Yeah. But really, it just, the first movie, we got hints of her. And, you know, there's the comment in the doc that even talks about Queenie's remark. And, you know, we'll get into that, but we're still talking about the flames and everything right now. So I just think that you can't build up this character and then, you know, have her come on screen and just be so amazing and have so many people love her despite, you know, the fact that you really kind of shouldn't, but you still do, and then just, like, kill her off in a very, like, kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, so many other people, quote, died in that scene that it feels a little cheap to take her out that way. I feel like her death, if that was her death, should have been bigger, should have been more, you know, because...
does her death, does it help or hinder Grindelwald in any way? Like, would have keeping her alive have, like, hurt Grindelwald? Like, is there any reason why he would want her dead, or maybe is there a reason why he wouldn't have wanted her to die?
Well, she broke his hookah, or she broke his skull thingy. I think that's what it says in Calling All Witches. Let me double check.
I don't remember.
I couldn't remember that.
Me neither.
Maybe it says it in the screenplay.
I was gonna say, the only thing I could think of is maybe she knew the actual identity of Credence, and he's just making up this Dumbledore. Aurelius Dumbledore lie.
If anything, I feel like she just knows what Credence isn't.
Yeah.
Like, she knows that he for sure isn't Corvus, or at least she thinks she knows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that would support Grindelwald's deciding to tell him that he's a Dumbledore, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Calling All Witches does say that she refused heroically attacking him and destroying the apparatus he used for his visions. And it's in the screenplay as well. It says that she points her wand at the skull in Rosier's hands, which explodes. Rosier is knocked backwards and Grindelwald is momentarily obscured in a whirl of chaos.
You just go buy another skull hookah.
They have it at the Halloween section in Target.
Go on eBay. Yeah. Go on, Grindelwald. Get it together. I don't remember that part. That's so weird. I watched it like last week or 2 weeks ago. I guess there's a lot happening in that scene. Yeah, it's really hard to keep up. But yeah, I mean, I do specifically remember the blue flames were coming after Newt and Theseus, and she was distracting Grindelwald and trying to save them in that way. But that was really the only reason, like, that was the only thing that led her to, you know, walking into the flames and like being like, I love you and all of that. But it's like 5 minutes later, she could have escaped with them. Like, you know,
right.
It's so frustrating. I'm just like, why? Just why? It's so, gosh, I'm not going to get into all of the reasons I'm frustrated by that movie or that scene. I'm just not. I mean, I even forgot about the whole like blue flame dragon thing that was happening. Like, I was just like, wait a minute. So much is going on. But I guess it just kind of, to circle back, it just wouldn't feel, her death doesn't feel earned at that point, if that makes sense.
Like, yeah.
Even though she told her story and said what she did, blah de blah, I still didn't feel like, well, she's gotta die now. Like, it just, at least not in that way. I don't know. It was deeply unsatisfying.
I mean, there
not
is
not saying that I should be satisfied, but
there is the fact that, you know, she lived her whole life feeling guilty that she was responsible for her brother's death, basically. And that as when she died, she got to, I guess, I don't know if I want to say got to, but she ended up sacrificing herself for people that she loved. Mm-hmm. And that could have been her way of kind of balancing the scales. You know, like, I'm the reason that my brother died, so I should sacrifice myself to make sure that other people I love get to live.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of want to move on to the next comment because that kind of ties in with things. At the end of Fantastic Beasts the First, Queenie says that Leeta was a taker, and do we feel like now, knowing what we saw of Leeta's character from flashbacks and even just in this movie, is that consistent, or was Queenie pulling something from Newt's memories, like just kind of his vantage point, his point of view of things? Because we still don't really, do we really know the full story of why Newt was kicked out of Hogwarts and like what Leeta's part was in that?
I feel like somebody posted in the common room that, again, there's some kind of like paracanon material that says that Newt took the fall for something that Leeta did. But I meant to look into it before we started recording, but then I got distracted. So let me see here. I'm going to see if I can find it in the common room.
I'm just tired of like, have it in the movie or not at all. Like, don't tell me in some other thing that I have to buy. Like, I'm broke. I can't go out and buy all of these other things just to have all of the information. Like, it's different. It was different with the Harry Potter series, obviously, because it was like, you know, you read the books and sometimes they wouldn't include all of the things from the books into the movies. Like, that was just the way things worked. But, like, this is not.
Yeah, if you're not going to write novels that include more information, then don't make other sources.
Don't be like, buy this and then we'll tell you everything you need to know. No, that's not how things work, JK Rowling. That is not what my bank account allows. But as for the taker comment, I was honestly expecting, in the first movie, when we got around to the second movie, I was expecting Leeta to be a lot more
selfish?
Yeah, I was gonna say unlikable.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh no, you broke my poor Newt's heart. But then we see the flashbacks, and then we see her interacting with Newt and Theseus, and even in her interaction with Tina, like, she helps her up, and, like, they have, like, kind of a moment of understanding, like, oh, you know, like, I don't know, like, I just kind of got a moment from them where she was like, yeah. Oh, you're the one Newt likes, even though she doesn't, like, say that out loud. It's like, you know, girls know. and I didn't really get that from her character, and maybe there was some sort of, like, maybe Newt's memory of her was that way, and mm-hmm. she's kind of, like, tried to atone for it in recent years or something. I don't know.
I mean, it could have something to do with the fact that she ended up with Theseus instead of mm-hmm. Newt. We don't know whether or not, you know, maybe she cheated on Newt with Theseus, or maybe she just chose Theseus over Newt, or... We don't know, and it could be, the taker comment could be something to do with that rather than, like, what got him expelled from Hogwarts, or, mm-hmm. like, we don't know how that relationship ended and how her relationship with Theseus started, but I will say that when I saw Crimes of Grindelwald for the first time, I definitely expected, I don't know, that she had broken Newt's heart, but yeah. It kind of seemed the other way around.
Yeah. Like, that first scene where they're in the ministry, I was just skimming through the screenplay, and she talks about how Newt was in detention because he sass talked a professor, and mm-hmm. she was like, oh, and I threw a dung bomb to be in detention with you. Do you remember that? And he goes, no. And yeah. So I kind of get the feeling that she needed him more than he needed her.
Yeah.
At least, although that's post-Theseus, so maybe when they were younger, it was different, the balance was different, but when we meet them now, it really feels like she needs him more than he needs her.
Yeah. And that go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I kind of get the feeling that maybe it was something like Leta was interested in Newt as more than friends, and Newt never acted on it or something, and so then when Theseus decided to pursue her, she agreed mm-hmm. since she didn't think that she had a future with Newt or something. So I feel like maybe it's she's pining for him more than he ever pined for her, but he did like her, he probably just didn't pursue it.
Right.
That's just kind of like what I picture.
I mean, Entertainment Weekly has referred to Leta explicitly as Newt's ex-love, so something happened, maybe, or...
Maybe, yeah.
But we didn't receive any sort of confirmation of that.
Yeah. He did have a picture of her in his suitcase. And it's not like it's not like he had a bunch of pictures in there, you know?
Right.
That picture stood out, and that's why Queenie was like, oh, who's that? And then, you know, that whole conversation. But Leta's relationship with Theseus, that... I wish we had kind of figured out more about that, because we're sitting here theorizing, like, oh, you know, maybe this happened, or like, oh, maybe they met this way. Like, why couldn't they just tell us, like, oh, they got together a few years back and, you know, they knew each other through Newt, or, you know, just something as simple as that mm-hmm. would have been totally fine. But instead, it's this whole, like, weird guessing game, and even Tina assumes that they're engaged because the article got it incorrect, and it's just like, just tell us, just, you know, just tell us what happened. Like, oh, you know.
Like, you can't, I feel like it's cruel to hint to the fact that Newt and Leta had something in the first film, and then just start the second film with Leta and Theseus being engaged, but not, like, fill in any of those blanks.
Exactly, because we even get the moment when she's at Hogwarts, she goes to the desk and sees the initials carved, which are Newt and Leta. And, like, who carved them? Was it her or was it Newt? And you kind of get the sense that it was her mm-hmm. because she knew where to go and she knew where to find it. And she was, you know, having all those flashbacks and just her seeking out Newt. And it's just like, oh, so frustrating. Oh, my God.
It definitely seems like more unrequited love on her end than on his. But then we also know that he loved her, too. So, I mean, I want to know why they aren't together and why Seriously. She ended up with Theseus. It doesn't. Oh, I just want to know.
Well, I mean,
it's like they're trying to create Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, like, I'm just thinking about, like, if you look at this Commander Boys objectively, and, like, I'm a Slytherin, we're ambitious.
Which one's the hottest?
Like, objectively, at the time that, you know, Leta's 17, 18, maybe early 20s, Theseus is objectively the better choice. He's a war hero. He's got a steady job at the ministry. He's cute. Not that Newt isn't cute, but he's real cute.
I feel like that it strongly depends on who you're talking to.
I know.
Honestly, I'm like, he loves animals? Yes. Like, like, I'm for that. I'm not for, you know, Mr. Serious War Hero. Like, yeah, they're both attractive. They are, like, 100%. If their personalities were reversed, like, I'd probably still go for whoever loved animals. Like, it would just... like, that wouldn't even... I don't know. But I see what you're saying about Leta going for Theseus for those reasons. Because I think she kind of grew up with a sense of insecurity. Mm-hmm. And maybe Theseus gave her a sense of security. He offered her, like, some sort of protection. But he was also, like, you also see him being a very gentle, caring person. Yeah. You know, he's not entirely stoic. You know, he gives his brother a hug. And, like, you know, he's very sweet to Leta in the moments we see them together. So it's not like he's, like, this kind of stonewall of a person. He's a strong man, but with feelings. And
yeah,
I think
he clearly adores
Leta,
her.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I could see how that would be appealing for someone like Leta, who, you know, she tells her story, and it's this very tragic thing, and she lives with these fears that she's a horrible person, and that, you know, nothing she ever does will redeem that one horrible moment. And it just kind of, I don't know, like, maybe with Newt, because even when she says to Newt, you know, I don't know the line verbatim, but you never could, like, there never was a monster.
Oh, like a monster you couldn't love.
Yeah. Yeah. And so she views herself as a monster, at least in Newt's eyes. But maybe with Theseus, she didn't have to be that person.
I don't know. I feel like it's something like there was something that Theseus could give her that Newt couldn't. Like, whether or not, I feel like it could have been, like, romantic love or affection or, I don't know, attention that Newt just didn't want to or couldn't give her.
Theseus just spoke her love language.
Yeah, like, I think you're onto something there, Helene. Like, Theseus, like I said, he clearly adores her. He's affectionate towards her. And Newt takes a movie, 2.5 movies, or I'm sorry, a movie and a half, to tell Tina that she has salamander eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. That boy takes a minute. And maybe Leta didn't, that wasn't what she needed.
Yeah. She wanted something more direct, maybe. And I feel like Newt's like a, I don't know, he has to come out of his shell a little bit, because even the biggest thing, the biggest, like, romantic gesture he did for Tina in the first movie was, like, tucking the hair behind her ear. Like, you know, like, yeah. that's very kind of slow moving, and, you know, they still haven't kissed at this point, and we're all just like, oh my gosh, come on, just, like, get together already.
Newt is the
Leta
slow
was just,
burn.
Like, tired. Yeah, like, Leta was like, I need someone who's just gonna, like, kiss me and, like, mean it. And maybe Theseus was just more direct in that way. Because even when he hugs Newt, like, he just goes in for the hug. And he knows Newt isn't wholly comfortable with it. But he's like, here's my affection. You are going to have it. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's probably just more affectionate than Newt. And maybe even just that small thing. Well, actually, it's not a small thing in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, maybe for Leta, that was what she needed. Because it sounds, especially when she was growing up, like, she didn't have a lot of affection. It was withheld from her because her father's favorite child was Corvus.
Right.
And she was just kind of, like, put on the back burner. So, you know, maybe even just something like that, like, oh, he he's showing me affection. He's showing me love. And it made her feel special. It made her feel
seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it could be just even something like that. But hey, how about telling us just like how they got together, even just like a flashback of like them at a coffee shop and he just like reaches for her hand and they gaze into each other's eyes and it's love. Like it doesn't like it does not have to be a whole other movie. It can just be a quick minute of like flashback of backstory for us to just not sit here and guess like how did they get together. Like it doesn't. No, like, you usually don't have to guess how people get together in real life, because they will often tell you. Someone asks me, like, oh, how did you and Steven meet? I will tell you our story from the very second we met to now. Like, it is not a big mystery. So, it's like they're trying to do this wonky love triangle thing with, like, Theseus and Leda and Newt and Tina, and it's just like, it's not necessary. It's not needed. And I know, like, at the end when she says the I love you, and in the script it says she says it to both of the brothers. Like, are we supposed to see that as she means it in a romantic way across the board? She just means it romantically to her fiancé and platonically to her future-ish brother-in-law or slash, you know, former best friend? Like, or was it even reverse? Like, where she was like, I'm finally gonna tell Newt I love him and I love Theseus, but, like, in a different way. Like, what? It shouldn't be this big guessing game in a movie full of things we already don't know what the F is going on. You know,
this is another reason why I feel like her entire existence is just one big fail of the Bechdel test. Like, everything that she is there. She's there specifically for Newt and Theseus, and that just angers me because she is such a strong, complex character, and we don't need her death to just be something that defines whether or not she loves Theseus more than Newt or loves Newt more than Theseus. Like, that doesn't matter. She's dying. That's what matters.
Yeah.
She's sacrificing herself for the cause. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was a person before either of them came into her life, which we saw through, you know, flashbacks and the baby swapping incident, like, which we'll get into. But it's just
don't do this to my girl.
I know, right? Yeah,
exactly. Like, they give us the first movie, and they give us these two strong female characters out of Tina and Queenie, you know, strong in their own right, in their own different ways. And they're not defined by their relationships to Newt and Jacob. But it's like the second movie, even Tina becomes like this jealous person who goes off and finds a boyfriend because she thinks Newt's engaged. And then Queenie, that whole cluster, which I've ranted about before and won't do again right now.
Like, Queenie's Queenie's entire story has turned into something about Jacob.
I love Jacob!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, it's deeply frustrating because I loved how they built the characters in the first movie. You know, I feel like we got very well-rounded characters, each with something different to bring to the table, and they worked well together, and they, like, they were just people. Like, you could look at them and be like, oh, that's Newt. You know, this is what he likes, and this is what we know about him. And, oh, then here's Jacob, and, oh, here's Tina, and, you know, this is what we know about her. And, oh, also, you know, Queenie, she's got, you know, these personality traits. And, like, I thought it was far more interesting in the first movie that Queenie!
That's a beautiful
they don't have a ship name. No.
Yeah. Oh, Lord have mercy.
Or Teenie.
That Queenie was a legilimens than the fact that she was in love with a nomad. You know? Like, I was like, that's something we hadn't seen out of, I mean, like, to a certain degree with the Voldemort, but he wasn't just, like, born that way, you know? It wasn't just, like, an innate ability, as with Queenie. Like, kind of like Tonks and her, I can never pronounce it,
Metamorphosis?
Thank you, yes.
I'm, like, blanking on the word.
I was just like, I am going to butcher this and I don't want to, like, try to say it. But yes, like, how Tonks was born with that as opposed to, you know, most Aurors who have to, like, learn it. I thought those were things I liked about those characters, and they weren't, Tonks wasn't defined by her love of Lupin, and Queenie isn't defined by her love of Jacob. You know, like, they were their own characters before those men came into their lives, you know? It's just kind of...
And it kind of sucks that we didn't get to see that part of Leta very much. The only time we get to see Leta as a character with outside of Newt and Theseus, without them having been in her life, is when she has her baby swapping incident, which is does not show the best decision making and isn't the very best portrayal of who she has, who she is as a person. I feel like that's actually her worst part of her life, her worst trait. And of course, that's the one time we see her as like her own person.
Yeah. And the whole baby swapping incident. I mean, we've talked a little bit before about, you know, certain moments that make a character irredeemable and to the degree where it's like, okay, well, they have to die now. Because, like, we've talked about this with Queenie. Like, she's kind of past the point now where she can fully redeem herself. Like, she's probably going to die. Blah,
she hasn't killed anyone yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, she's not done great things is the problem. She's being naive and just silly. But with Leta, I feel like that doesn't, I don't know what this says about me, but I feel like that doesn't make her irredeemable because there was no way she could have predicted what was going to happen. You know, like there was no way to know that, oh no, you know, the other boat would capsize and, you know, the baby would, you know, go underwater.
Also,
she was so young.
I was going to say, also, she was very young.
Yeah. She's four. Like, the logical course of action, I mean, for basically a baby of her own right, in her own right, she's going to think, oh, here's an identical baby. I'm just going to swap it out. And if the boat hadn't sunk that night, if the other lifeboat hadn't gone down, Irma would have looked at the baby, go, oh, this is not my baby. Leta, what did you do? They would have swapped the babies back. She would have gotten in trouble, and that would have been it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, you... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it speaks to her character also that this weighed on her so heavily for her entire life after that. Like, and that's what her boggart was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that says something, like, evil people don't do things like that and then feel guilty about them for the rest of their lives, you know? Like, they don't just...
Like, what she didn't do it with malicious intent. I think that's, like, the main thing is that, like, she didn't do this, like, saying, I'm gonna kill my brother. Like, that obviously wasn't what she wanted. She was a young girl, and I think that when you do something when you're that young, not really knowing what the possibilities are that can happen out of what you do, you're not fully to blame for anything that might come out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Personally, I think that if she had gone in there saying, like, I'm going to take this baby and I'm going to throw it off the side of the boat. Like, that's different.
That's when I would have said, okay, not Leta, not my favorite character.
But she just was like, I just want some peace and quiet. I'm going to put this baby in this room for a little bit. And, you know, maybe in an hour I'll go and I'll switch him back, you know?
Yeah, like, she didn't know that the boat was sinking. Like, there was just some sort of kerfuffle happening on the ship. Like, she didn't know what was going on. And I don't think she even really understood the consequences of what she was doing. She was just like, oh my God, shut this baby up. You know, like, and I think we've all had those moments. We just haven't swapped babies because of it. Like, you know, you walk into Target sometimes and hear a kid screaming. You're just like, oh no. But, like, you don't go up to the kid and slap its face. Like, you know, because maybe we're, like, adults. Well, I'm a Hufflepuff and it's not in my genes. I don't know. She was a Slytherin. No, I'm kidding. That has nothing to do with anything.
I'm just saying, there's a Target and Dust Plains I can't go to anymore.
Yeah. But she was a child and she didn't understand. And, like, she, like you said, just wanted some peace and quiet. Like, she just wanted a moment away from the crying. And also, she did kind of hold a grudge against Corvus because he was, in her father's eyes, the golden child, you know?
Yeah.
And that also probably played into her decision making because she was just like, let me just get rid of him for a second. There was no way to possibly know what was going to happen. And I think the fact that, I mean, even if an adult had did that, I would hold it against an adult because I'm like, okay, like, what are you doing swapping babies? But the fact that she was a child and, like, there was no way to know what would happen, I think that doesn't make her
horrible person. It in no way makes her irredeemable. I think that her character is very deemable, if that is a word. redeemable, sorry.
Yeah. She can be deemable, too. We can just make that a thing.
We can deem her redeemable. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And you're right. Like, the fact that she felt so guilty about it, like, obviously, she was never come to terms with that decision that she made so long ago. And she, like, she should know in the end that anything that happened to Corvus was not directly her fault. But because she felt so guilty about it, she let herself believe that, you know, it was completely her fault, and therefore she carried that with her the rest of her life as her biggest fear and regret. So I think that that says something about her as a person.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we've got Kama, who literally has an unbreakable vow to kill Corvus, and just, like, hunting him down. It's just, it's like a totally... And yet we don't bat an eye at that. Like, I don't remember anybody really talking much about that. It's all about, you know, Lita's big, like, the fact that they're standing in that, mausoleum or whatever it is, and they're telling the stories, and they're all like, oh no, Lita, oh no, and it's like, but Calm is, like, literally here to kill him, and she has to be the one to be like, no, that's not Corvus, because here's what happened. Like, it's just, y'all were gonna be okay with him just straight up killing him? Like, I get that the whole situation's messed up, but, like, the child did not do anything wrong, even if that was Corvus.
Also, how is it magically possible to make an unbreakable vow to kill someone who is already dead?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking, too.
Like, yeah.
If this is off topic, but...
No.
That's
but
true.
If Kama still has the unbreakable vow on him, presumably it would have broken when Corvus died, or maybe because, like, I don't remember the timeline. Did Kama's dad die before Corvus came to America? Let me check my screenplay. Because if he, like, set the unbreakable vow after Corvus was dead already,
Then it shouldn't have been possible
unless, like...
It's pretty null and void.
Well, unless the unbreakable curse, like, on the unbreakable vow only depends on the intent of the caster. And as far as Kama's dad knew, Corvus was still alive. I don't know. Let me look at the timeline on here.
Confirmation.
Or he took this unbreakable vow to kill Corvus, and then Corvus died afterwards, and then maybe the unbreakable vow was lifted. But, like, how do you know if the unbreakable vow that you made is, like, lifted or not?
If
it is lifted, you just don't die. And then that, I mean, like, if you're still alive, then that's no indication that an unbreakable vow has lifted, you know, because you're living every day until you die.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, I mean, maybe it's, like, some small confirmation that maybe Corvus isn't dead?
I don't know.
Theory. Because it would suck to just chase after something your whole life and be like, oh no, he was dead a long time ago. Like, I mean, good, but also, like, kind of bad. Because, like, what are you going to do? Like, if you can't fulfill an unbreakable vow because it's already been fulfilled by somebody, like, what? That's weird. That's, like, tricky. And also, what kind of father makes his son do an unbreakable vow to kill another person? Like, that's really...
A really bad father.
Yeah.
Do not do that to your child. That's, I don't care how much you hate the other person. He should have... I mean, not... Again, I just said, you know, don't do unbreakable vows to kill people. But if he was gonna kill anyone, it should have been Lita's father.
Okay, so I'm rereading the screenplay, and... The unbreakable, Kama says, the news of his mom's, Lita's mom's death drove my father insane. With his dying breath, my father charged me to seek revenge. Kill the person Lestrange loves best in the world. I thought at first it would be easy. He had only one close relative, you. But, Lita, say it. Comma. He never loved you.
So technically the unbreakable vow was to kill whoever her father loved most.
Exactly, yeah. So then it kind of transferred to who, comma, assumed Lestrange loved most, which was Corvus Jr.
So if there's someone else out there who Lita's father loved more, then that's who the unbreakable vow is about. And that's who Kama has to kill.
Mm-hmm. So it was definitely before Corvus died, or potentially didn't die, depending on who Corvus actually is. And if he's assuming that it is Corvus, then that means that the unbreakable vow is still in effect, and Corvus might still be alive.
The thing is, how does the unbreakable vow know that he, like, how do you fail that? Other than, like, him dying through some other way or being killed by somebody else, that's the only way that he would fail to kill whoever is the subject of the unbreakable vow, right? So the only way he fails the unbreakable vow and dies himself is if Corvus or whoever the vow is about dies first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the fact that Kama is alive means that Corvus is alive.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Or whoever the vow is about is alive.
Welp, guys, we solved it.
So off topic. I'm sorry.
Not really. I mean, Lita's though, still involved. Their stories are so intertwined.
I mean, maybe plot twist, Lita is the person that her father actually did love most. But now that she's dead, that means that he would have failed and he would have died.
Kama's still crude. Screwed. I can't talk.
Kama's like, no!
Why are all these people dying before I can kill them? just my luck. Oh god.
But we see Kama alive at the end of the movie, so yeah. We know that his mission is still unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, any other thoughts or comments regarding Lita at all?
I love her and I hope she comes back.
Hashtag Lita lives.
And semi-related news, did y'all see that Zoe Kravitz is going to be Catwoman?
Is she?
No.
Yeah. It was, like, just announced today, so.
I love her.
Oh my god. That's, like, in the DC Cinematic Universe? Not the
CE. In the movie with Robert Pattinson as Batman.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for it. But I'm also worried because I'm like, when does it film and when does Fantastic Beasts 3 film?
Well, didn't Eddie just finish like a big movie? I feel like that might have been a reason why Fantastic Beasts was delayed, because he just finished the filming of a big movie, I think.
I don't know.
Entertainment Weekly says that that the Batman is going to start filming in January of next year.
That's really not that far.
No, that's like in a couple months.
I was like, oh, January of next year. Oh, that's forever from now. I'm like, wait, it's October, Ariel. Get it together. I always like, whenever it's October, I'm like, it's like May, right? No, it's October.
So what we need to do, what we need to do is keep an eye out on IMDb until they have a page about the third Fantastic Beasts movie, and then we need to see if Zoe Kravitz is on there.
Because it doesn't come out until November of 2021, so I feel like filming... We've got plenty of time. And if they're filming in January of next year,
and when we spoke to Dan, they hadn't gotten the strips yet, and that was at the beginning of October. So
okay,
yeah.
Well then, we're good. We're fine. She can be Catwoman and Lita. Oh, well, I guess that wraps it up for main discussion. And if you want to take it away with Time Turner.
I would love to. Thank you.
A few times should do it, love.
So, in today's spooky episode of Spook Beastie, I am doing a Time Turner about a theater that revolutionized special effects and theater, and really this is one of the things that when I heard that Speak Beastie 2 Fantastic Beasts 2 was taking place in Paris in the space between World War One and World War Two, I was so excited because I thought this is the perfect place to have a cameo for the Grand Guignol Theater. No dice. It's fine. It's fine. I'm definitely not bitter and still not over it. And it's been like a year. Anyway, so Marjolaine, as always, I'm so sorry for all the butchering that I do of your beautiful language. My pronunciation and a lot of my information is from the episode Stuff You Missed in History Class about the Grand Guignol. So if you have a problem with my pronunciation or my research, take it up with the girls from Stuff You Missed in History Class. So, Le Théâtre des Grands Guignols was founded in 1893 in Paris by Oscar Metenier to tell a kind of naturalist theater, which is about the unseen people, homeless people, sex workers, hustlers, that kind of thing. And he wanted to have that, tell that kind of story in a very small space. So the theater is only about 290 seats, and the stage itself is only about 20 feet by 20 feet. So it's tiny. It's a very small black box theater. The space is a former chapel, and there's angel statues above the orchestra pit, and the balconies were styled like confessional boxes. So Metenier's focus was visceral and gruesome true crime stories. And it was immediate success. People came flooding to the theater. And he alternated these really gruesome short plays with comedies in an approach of what was called hot and cold theater. So that when you saw a comedy right after horror, it seemed funnier. And then the horror seemed scarier. Metenier stepped down from the theater in 1898 because he felt that the quality of storytelling was declining. He didn't think they would be able to keep telling these stories, and he didn't want to be associated with it with a lower quality of story. So Max Maury takes over in 1898, and his focus was less on telling these stories of the unseen and more on, well, to give you an idea, The genre of plays that he focused on were called slice of death. People were beheaded, disemboweled, had their eyes gouged out on stage, and two people, on average, passed out per night.
I was one of them.
Well, it might have been, if you and Stephen had attended, it actually might have been Stephen, because more men passed out than women. Because
well, passing out is like my thing, so... I just called dibs on it.
All right. Well, okay.
I don't even
so
need
in your
to
case,
see anything gross.
But more
we'll
men...
We'll both just pass out.
Actually passed out because ladies tend to just cover their eyes during the scary parts and men didn't.
Oh, you know, I do that, though.
So see, Stephen would have... And you would have been fine.
I would have seen that he passed out and then I would have passed out. Oh, no. I'd be like, no. I'm one of those people, like, if I see someone's crying, I cry.
Aww.
So, like, I guess if... It's not... Aww.
No, it's cute.
That's not... It's not like a... It's just, like, my eyes start watering. It's not like I'm like, oh, you're sad, let me be sad, too. Like, it's just like a... Don't... Stop making me out to be some sort of soft Hufflepuff.
Ariel,
I'm
not. Sorry,
but
you're
I'm
a soft
so
Hufflepuff.
Hardcore. I'm super hardcore. You have no idea. I wouldn't pass out because I would cover my eyes and I would be so strong.
Well, anyway, even if you and Steven did pass out, you would be okay because there was a doctor on site, just in case, because that was also
very
a selling
convenient.
Point because he was like, my plays are so scary that there's going to be a doctor on site.
I would definitely attend. I'd be like, there's going to be a doctor there? Yes. Who knows what could happen? Oh, man. He was prepared for everything.
He was.
Good on him.
So in 1915, Camille Choisy took over. And this was after World War One, so he was worried that at this point, the World War One had jaded people to the point that they wouldn't find the offering shocking anymore. So he started focusing on really ripped from the headline stuff, setting plays in dirigibles and in mines and using modern weapons like poison gas and grenades. He also hired an actress named Paula Maxa as their star actress. She was murdered over 10,000 times over her career at the Grand Guignol, in addition to being tortured and mauled and even decomposing on stage.
Ugh.
She also yelled for help over 900 times.
Same.
Choisy ran the theater for 15 years, and the Grand Guignol was extremely popular during this time. People from royalty to just regular working class people would come and see the shows. They would attend opening nights in formal wear, and presumably they would then be like, why did I wear my fancy dress when I'm all going out into a back alley to puke all over myself? This is a terrible idea. So 1930, Jacques Jovan comes on as the director. Around this time, people actually are starting to lose interest because his stories tended to be less focused, like ripped from the headlines, gory, focused on that kind of thing, and more themed around a single idea. Like, he'd do a bunch of plays around a single concept as opposed to doing the hot and cold theater. And Universal monster movies were starting to come out around that same time, and despite pulling their inspiration from the Grand Guignol, they were actually pulling audiences away from the Grand Guignol. And in 1937, a British actress named Eva Bergson took over. It started regaining some popularity, but then she had to flee Paris in 1940, return to Britain when the Germans invaded. The Grand Guignol stayed open during World War II. It did entertain the German soldiers, which is... And that is why people kind of stopped going to the Grand Guignol after World War II. Because they were like, you stayed open to entertain the Germans. We don't wanna. And also, they were so scarred by World War II and what had happened right there in their city that they weren't really interested in escaping to the theater to see that kind of thing when it had happened to their families and in places they knew and loved.
I was just gonna say, it's not like entertainment anymore after that, because a lot of soldiers specifically probably had, you know, PTSD, and it would have been very triggering for them to watch that kind of reenacted on stage, so... that's all I was really going to say about that. Like, that's not the best subject matter.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the final director of the Grand Guignol, Charles Nonon, said, we could never equal Buchenwald. Before the war, everyone felt that what was happening on stage was impossible. Now we know these things and worse are possible in reality. So it wasn't fun anymore. It wasn't escapism. It wasn't that kind of rush of adrenaline and catharsis. It was just, oh, this happened to my brother and now I'm being reminded to it and that sucks.
Yeah.
So Le Théâtre du Grand Guignol finally closed its doors in 1962. The space is currently host to another theater company. So it's still being used as a theater, but not quite for the same purposes. And... So that is the history of the theater Le Théâtre du Grand Guignol. And this is something that is very dear to my heart. It is in one of my very favorite TV shows, Penny Dreadful. It plays a big part in the first season of that.
Oh my gosh, I was hoping you would bring up Penny Dreadful.
Yep. Despite being in the wrong city and the wrong time period, it plays a huge part. And that I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like if the second Fantastic Beasts movie takes place at the same time as the Grand Guignol is having its height of popularity, can you even imagine a magical version of this theater?
Oh, man. I would faint. I honestly, it's just going, you talking about, like, how, you know, people... I guess I didn't necessarily think about it in terms of, you know, people would go and... see these scary and gruesome and grotesque things as a form of escapism and it'd be entertaining. And then after the war, it was so, like, just the wrong thing to be showing on stage anymore. Like, I never really thought about that because I knew enough about the theater, but I didn't, like, delve as deep into it as you did with the Time Turner. So learning about that was fascinating. But also kind of sad because, like, the quote that you said, I can't remember the name of the guy, but when they were saying, like, you know, they used to go to the theater for these things that they thought were, like, impossible, and now that they knew they were possible, and, like, even worse things mm-hmm. were possible. It's sad, but at least, you know, they weren't trying to, like, force anything down anyone's throats. Like, oh, no, but, you know, like, it's kind of like, you know, they understood their time had come and gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to visit the space, even though it's not the same. It still would be so cool to go there and to see kind of what used to be.
Yeah.
And especially with Penny Dreadful. I loved Penny Dreadful. So, I was when you first mentioned that you're going to be covering this, I meant to say something about Penny Dreadful, but then I was like, I mean, I'm not going to change the subject and, like, talk about a totally different thing. And then you brought it up. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, then it's fair game.
Yeah, no, one of my very absolute all-time favorite shows.
Oh, man. So. Oh, man. I just realized, I don't think I know everyone's Hogwarts and Ilvermorny houses.
Hufflepuff and Pukwudgie.
Slytherin, Thunderbird.
Okay. I'm Hufflepuff and Thunderbird. So I'm like...
Part me and part Anne.
Yeah!
I was like, that's interesting. I for sure thought I was going to be Pukwudgie. That was really weird to me when I wasn't. Because I was like, what?
Dan is a Hufflepuff and a Pukwudgie.
That's adorable.
We're twins.
That makes sense.
We also have the same Patronus.
What's Patronus?
Well, he technically says that his is a squirrel riding a dolphin.
The squirrel fin!
Yep. So go listen to that episode of interviewing Dan Fogler, because he talks all about this. But mine is a dolphin.
Sorry,
so bye-bye. I'm pretty sure that if he actually, I think he actually took the test and it was a dolphin, but I'm sure that he just identifies more with a squirrel riding a dolphin, which I can understand.
So totally are sense. You guys like besties now? Because you interviewed him. You did this thing at NYCC with him. Like, do you guys like Netflix and hang out together?
I mean, I want to sound really cool and say yes, but I don't know, maybe he would be able to recognize me out of a face of like crowd of faces, but other than that, probably not.
Like if you were in a police lineup, he would know.
Oh, he would be it wasn't
that's
her.
Not the criminal. Yeah. That's my friend. We have if the same only. Patronus.
So I met him at Wizard World, but it was one of those, like, cattle call photo op things, so he 100% would not be able to recognize me, because it was, like, in, hi, smile, out.
Yeah, and at this point I've interviewed him twice, one at San Diego Comic-Con for MuggleNet, and then for the podcast. And
oh, now that's right.
And then I also met him at New York Comic-Con last weekend, so, I mean, I... Besties. Definitely remember all those things, but I doubt he does. I mean, I should just give him a call. Get him to have Jude Law sing me a sea shanty.
Yeah!
Oh my gosh.
That's also a throwback to the interview with Dan Fogler. All of you listeners, if you have not listened to it, you should. It's quite great.
I mean, Dan, in general, is pretty great. Okay, so that concludes our episode, and our podcast question is... Do you feel Lita's story was fully fleshed out, or was she shortchanged for the purpose of Newt and Theseus's own stories? We'd love to hear from you, so please drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets, or you can email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And as always, you can leave us a beautiful, lovely, nice, awesome review on iTunes, because you love us.
You can find us on all of the social medias. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie, Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBeastie, Tumblr at SpeakBeastiePodcast.tumblr.com, and you can also support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/SpeakBeastie.
I'm Ariel.
I'm Helene.
I'm Anne, and thanks for listening to Speak Beastie. Case closed.